by building on what Dr. Feierstein said, is that he talked about how you carry the action potential down the axon of the neuron. So here's a neuron, and here's the synaptic bouton at the end. So we have an action potential going down the axon. And he talked a bit about what happens at the synapse, the connection between one cell and the next. And I want to elaborate on that a little bit. You may remember that this is the presynaptic side, while this is the post. And this space in the middle is the synaptic cleft. And the question that he was addressing is, how does a nerve impulse go from the presynaptic side across the cleft to the postsynaptic side? Now, in a very small number of cases, these two membranes are right up against each other. You have gap junctions and you have an electrical connection. But in almost every case, you have a chemical connection between the pre and the post. Now, in other words, that neurotransmitter is released by exocytosis from the presynaptic side and binds to receptors on the postsynaptic side. And he said that there, well, let me just say that in any one synapse, there is always one major neurotransmitter and one type of receptor. Now, a single neuron may make more than one synapse. The pictures we drew, there's always just one synapse. But if you look at their other pictures, you know that the axon can branch and synapse on other cells. So one individual cell releases the same major neurotransmitter at each synapse. So the presynaptic signal, the neurotransmitter, is going to be the same at both of these synapses. Now, on the receptor side, we'll return to that in more detail. Most neurotransmitters have more than one type of receptor. And whether this signal, the chemical signal that goes across, is excitatory or inhibitory depends on the receptor. Some neurotransmitters are always excitatory or always inhibitory. But some neurotransmitters can be either one depending on the type of receptor. And Dr. Feierstein said in the central nervous system, that's the brain and the spinal cord, the main neurotransmitters are GABA and glutamate, the amino acid. But in the peripheral nervous system, which is what we're going to be talking about mostly, that is the synapses outside the brain and the spinal cord. In that case, the neurotransmitter is usually either acetylcholine, usually abbreviated ACCH, or norepinephrine, NE. Now, we've talked about epinephrine already as a hormone. Norepinephrine, which is very similar, minus 1-methyl, is primarily a neurotransmitter. The two compounds are very similar. They're similar in action. They have similar receptors. But generally, norepinephrine is the primary transmitter, and epinephrine is the primary endocrine or hormone. So we'll talk about these and their receptors as we go. Now, Dr. Feierstein explained how you establish a resting membrane potential and how when you get a stimulus over threshold, that generates an action potential, and the action potential regenerates itself. It was propagated all the way down to the end. And then, as we've said several times, the release of calcium is what triggers almost always exocytosis. So calcium release causes release of neurotransmitter, which then carries the message. Now, we didn't go into it, but when you have a calcium spike in a cell, The calcium can come from the outside of the cell by opening channels. That's what happens here. There are voltage-gated calcium channels. When the action potential comes down, they're opened. That leads to a spike of calcium in the cytoplasm, and that leads to exocytosis. As we will see later, in many other cells, calcium is stored inside the endoplasmic reticulum or other places in the cell, but usually in the ER. And then, in response to the right signal, calcium can be released from internal stores, such as the ER. So calcium in the cytosol, in the cytoplasm, is kept very low. But it can rush in either from the outside or from stores on the inside in a subcellular compartment in response to, it can come from either one. I shouldn't say two. It should probably be this way. So calcium in the cytosol can go up because of an inrush either from outside or from within storage areas in the cell. Now, the part that Dr. Feierstein didn't talk about is how do you stop the signal? If you release a neurotransmitter, why doesn't it keep stimulating the postsynaptic cell forever? Now, we've talked about signaling before, and we talked about some examples. For example, if you use EGF, epidermal growth factor, as a signaling molecule, it's a big macromolecule. So how are you going to get rid of it? You get rid of it by endocytosis and sending it to a lysosome. But here, most of these neurotransmitters, these are small molecules. So how are you going to get rid of them? There's actually several different ways that you want to clear them out of the synaptic cleft. And one way to do that is simply by diffusion. After all, these are small molecules, and they diffuse away into the interstitial fluid, the blood, etc. Now, in some cases, diffusion isn't enough, and the actual transmitter has to be, in some way, actively removed. And one way is by degradation. For example, in many synapses that use acetylcholine, the enzyme acetylcholine esterase is found in the synapse. So it's made in one of the cells and secreted into the synapse, and it's lying there waiting. Now, acetylcholine is an acetate group linked to choline, and what this esterase does is to break this connection. And that causes it to be inactive because neither half by itself will bind to receptors and stimulate anything. So having an enzyme that gets rid of the transmitter is another way. And the third way of getting rid of transmitter is to take it back where it came from, uptake by the presynaptic cell. Or perhaps we should say reuptake. Now, some neurotransmitters are taken back up as is. For example, serotonin, which is used as a neurotransmitter, is released, and then it's transported back into the cells from which it came, packed into vesicles again, and we can use it over. Now, acetylcholine is degraded, but the choline part actually is taken back up into the cell from which it came. And then the choline is connected to new acetate, packed into vesicles, and is reused. Now, how do you take up serotonin, which I didn't spell right? How do you take up serotonin or choline? How do you get them across a membrane? There are active transporters for them. So reuptake of the small molecules is by secondary active transport, usually. Now, is it enough for this operation to continue if you release a transmitter, then to take it back up again, or to take it back up and rebuild it? If you kept releasing neurotransmitter, something else would happen. Every time you release neurotransmitter, what happens to the membrane here? Remember, you have exocytosis, and the membrane gets bigger. So not only do you have to recover the neurotransmitter or make new, you also want to recover that membrane by endocytosis so you can use it over again. So it takes active transport to get back the small molecule, but in addition to the reuptake by active transport, you also have endocytosis, to recover the membrane of the vesicle. And so you can make new vesicles and repack them. The point here is that when you have exocytosis, both the membrane of the vesicle fuses and the contents of the vesicle are expelled. But you get back the contents and the membrane by two separate processes. Now, some of the drugs that you know about actually interfere with these various processes of turning things off. Prozac is known to reduce the uptake, the rapid uptake of serotonin. So the idea is that it's an uptake inhibitor. So what is happening is the serotonin lasts long, in the presence of Prozac, the serotonin lasts longer in this cleft. It is not cleared out as quickly. It gets cleared out, but slower. Now, it's thought since Prozac also has long-term effects, not immediate ones, it's assumed it does other things as well. But the idea here is that in people who are depressed, perhaps, there is not enough serotonin, not enough nerve transmission. So by increasing the effective levels of serotonin, you increase transmission and you cure some of the symptoms. Now, this is a case where you think the transmission is lower than normal, and by adding a drug, you hope to raise transmission up to normal levels. But there's another compound, which is actually not a drug, it's an insecticide, malathion. This is used as an insecticide, and it's an inhibitor of acetylcholine esterase. Now, what will happen if you have acetylcholine is the neurotransmitter, and you inhibit the esterase? Will you get more transmission or less? Well, what does acetylcholine esterase do? It gets rid of the transmitter. So if we block getting rid of the transmitter, we'll have more transmitter. So this is another case with more transmitter. The only catch is you already have normal transmission and you juice it up. And in fact, the synapse that is affected is the synapse not between a nerve and a nerve, between a nerve and skeletal muscle. So what happens is there's too much stimulation of skeletal muscle, and in fact, the insect goes into spasms. If you've ever sprayed it around and watched your bugs on their back wiggling, that's what's happening. Fortunately, this does not have much effect on our equivalent hormone enzyme. So this drug is used, this compound is used very widely in order to overstimulate bugs and send them into spasms and they die. Now, I talked about turning off EGF signaling. That works by destruction, essentially, of the signal and of the receptor. Here we're talking about turning off nerve signaling by getting rid of the neurotransmitter. How do you turn off, say, a hormone that uses a G-protein-coupled receptor? Like, say, epinephrine. Epinephrine, acting as a hormone, or norepinephrine, acting as a neurotransmitter, affects a G-protein-coupled receptor. Now, it's true this is a small molecule, so by one of these methods, after a while, the signal leaves. The signal goes away. But if the signal has already acted, the G protein coupled activated the receptor, which has activated the G protein, which has activated adenyl cyclase, which has made cyclic AMP, which has activated protein kinase A, how do you turn that off? So you have to think back a minute. What does a G protein coupled receptor do? It activates the G protein. And remember, it does that by GTP substituting for GDP. But remember, these things turn themselves off. They have their own GTPase activity, and so a G protein will not stay active if it is not stimulated. And so the G protein will turn itself off. That means the adenyl cyclase won't be stimulated anymore. But what about the cyclic AMP that we made? Remember, there's an enzyme, phosphodiesterase, that destroys cyclic AMP and converts it into ordinary AMP. So in addition to the G protein turning itself off, the cyclic AMP is converted to plain old adenosine monophosphate by a phosphodiesterase, and therefore the whole thing goes off. But every time you have a signaling system, you have to think not just about how you turn it on, but also how you turn it off. Because you want a signal to be a brief kick and then stop. And you wait for the next one. Now, I want to shift the focus from sort of the presynaptic side and releasing neurotransmitter and getting rid of neurotransmitter and consider of how the signal is received on the postsynaptic side. So first let me ask, are there any presynaptic questions or anything else that has come up? Yeah?
I was wondering about the threshold in terms of the action potential. Is there anything that would change the threshold, like differences in the...
Well, you're asking about the threshold, which is really a postsynaptic event, which is what we want to talk about now, and there are things that change the threshold. So let's consider now the postsynaptic side, what is happening on the other side. So if we release neurotransmitter, and it's going to bind to receptors, and what's going to happen when you bind to these receptors is that you're either going to inhibit or activate this cell. Now, neurotransmitters virtually always cause, in the next nerve, either they cause hyperpolarization or depolarization. Now, what do we mean by that? Here's the voltage across the membrane. Here's the resting potential of minus 70 millivolts, approximately, and this is time. So if we were to record, say, from over here, the neurotransmitter is going to generally either, it's going to generally open channels, and therefore either we're going to hyperpolarize or we're going to depolarize. So I think as Dr. Feierstein said, if you have a little stimulus, you get something like this. But if this is threshold, it doesn't make any difference. This is not sufficient to set off an action potential. But this is called an excitatory postsynaptic potential, or an EPSP. Now, any kind of potential change over here is called a postsynaptic potential. That's a PSP, but it can be excitatory, but in some cases it can be inhibitory. This is called an inhibitory postsynaptic potential. Now you see, why do we call these excitatory and inhibitory? This change gets you closer to threshold, more likely to fire an action potential, although of course you haven't done it yet. because one EPSP is not sufficient to trigger an action potential in the next nerve. On the other hand, this change in potential took us further away from threshold, hyperpolarized the cell, and made it less likely that we will fire an action potential. So a hyperpolarization is when you get from inhibitory postsynaptic potential, and a depolarization is what you get in an excitatory postsynaptic potential. Now, if this is due to the opening of channels, what kind of channels did I open? So you remember that the cell is just a little bit minus relative to the outside, but it's basically, the cell is basically neutral. It has many, many anions, many, many cations, but there's a slight excess of minus around here because, remember, of the leakage primarily of potassium. Now, and remember, thanks to the pump, we have a lot of potassium inside relative to outside, and we have a lot of sodium outside relative to inside. So, if we open channels, how are we going to get an excitatory, now let's try inhibitory first. How are we going to get an inhibitory postsynaptic potential? That means we have to make the cell more minus. How could we make the cell more minus? We'd have to lose a positive or gain a negative. And cells become more minus then by which one are we going to lose? If we open a channel, what channel will allow us to get more minus? It would have to be which one? It would have to be potassium. Because if I open more channels for potassium, then what's going to happen is both the concentration gradient is out, and to some extent the electrical gradient is out also. Note, I said it the wrong way. The electrical gradient is this way for potassium, and the chemical gradient is this way. Now, if I open channels, a few ions will move out, more will move out, and the cell will become more negative. Now, it therefore, at inhibitory synapses, generally you open channels for potassium. Sometimes you open them for chloride, because if chloride rushes in or potassium rushes out, you get the same result. Now, at excitatory synapses, what you open at an excitatory synapse is you open a cation channel, which allows both sodium and potassium to go through. Why will that depolarize the cell? I want you to stop for a minute and think, talk to the person next to you. It's pretty obvious that if you only allowed one ion to move, you could depolarize the cell. After all, in action potential, what happens? Sodium rushes in and you depolarize the cell. But I just said that in order to get an excitatory postsynaptic potential, you do not open channels specific for sodium. You open general cation channels that allow both sodium and potassium to move. Why does that depolarize the cell? So think about that for a minute, and then we'll discuss. say something that perhaps I didn't say right before. We know there's more potassium inside than outside, and the chemical push is this way. But at minus 70, the electric balances the chemical. But the equilibrium potential, remember, for potassium is minus 90. So that's why if you open more channels for potassium, it will go to its equilibrium, toward its equilibrium potential, which is minus 90. It doesn't just stay there. Now, what happens if you open channels for both potassium and sodium? We know that potassium will go out. Which way will the sodium go? Sodium will go in, so why don't they just balance out? Well, the what were you going to say?
Well, the equilibrium potential for the sodium is up at plus 50. So it has both the electrical gradient going in and the chemical gradient going in.
So what she said is the push, both chemical and electrical on sodium, is this one. Now, this actually follows from the fact that you have very high sodium out here and the inside is negative regular to the outside, but also follows from the equilibrium potential values, as she mentioned, that the equilibrium potential for potassium is minus 90, but for sodium it is plus 55. Now, what this means is if you let the potassium rip, it will go toward minus 90, and if you let sodium rip, it will go toward plus 55. But since the sodium imbalance is, sodium is much further from its equilibrium than potassium is, much more sodium will move than potassium. Now, you can explain this in many different ways, but the basic idea is that there's a much stronger push on sodium than there is on potassium if you let them both go. And so a little more potassium comes out, but a huge amount of sodium goes in. Huge means enough to cause, huge is relative. Compared to the total concentration and the total amount of ions, it's negligible. Yeah?
If you want to depolarize the cell, why do you open the potassium one anyway? Don't you just want to just let the sodium?
Okay, he wants to have a specific sodium channel to do this instead of a sodium-potassium channel. And that would do it. But the assumption is that a less specific one that does the job is perhaps just as good. And you have to look at evolutionary history to ask why did it have this particular properties. But the general argument is you don't need a specific sodium one, although that would do it. That it's sufficient to open one for just monovalent cations. All right. Now, what's going to happen to this cell overall? Is this cell going to fire an action potential or not? Now, before we answer that, the short answer is you have to sum up all the iPSPs and EPSPs, because any one cell gets probably about 1,000 inputs, and it's the algebraic sum of all of them that makes the difference. But before we say that, we want to say a little something about why it is that a particular neurotransmitter generates either an iPSP or an EPSP. And the critical thing is the receptor. If the receptor opens one set of channels, you'll get an iPSP. If it opens another set of channels, you'll get an EPSP. And as we've already said, some neurotransmitters have more, in fact, most of them have more than one receptor. And one receptor may be inhibitory and one may be excitatory. And I want to talk about an example of that. Before we go on. What kind of receptor do we have over here? We're going to open some channels. That's what usually happens. In rare cases, you close some. But we're going to open or close some channels over here. What kind of receptor will do that? if the receptor is a channel itself, that's one way it can happen. But is that the only way? And it's not. Because you can have a receptor, which is a G protein coupled receptor, which activates a G protein, which further down the line, either the G protein or something it kicks, opens the actual channel. So this is something that actually Dr. Feierstein talked about, that there are two major kinds of receptors for these neurotransmitters. They are direct and indirect. As you might imagine, what a direct synapse involves is a receptor, which is itself a channel. So the receptor is actually part of a channel. In an indirect receptor, the receptor is not a channel, it's a G protein coupled receptor. Now, that means, well, what's so what? What difference does it make? In the long run, you're going to get a channel opened, and you're going to get either an IPSP or an EPSP. So what difference does it make? Well, practically speaking, one of these is faster than the other. Now, they're both very fast on a human timescale, but one of these is faster than the other. Because if you just bind to a channel protein and open it, that's it. But here, you bind to the G protein coupled receptor. It has to activate a G protein, and then the G protein has to activate the channel, or the G protein has to activate enzyme, which generates a second messenger, which activates the channel. So this one is a little faster. Now, another term that's used for these is ionotropic and metabotropic. Because in an ionotropic receptor, you actually open an ion channel directly, that's it. But in a metabotropic receptor, the receptor triggers some event of metabolism, which in turn opens the channel. But you don't open the channel directly. And as we'll see, both in nerve-nerve transmission and in nerve effector transmission and in sensors, you have both kinds of receptors. Now, one of the big differences is that in the case of a direct or ionotropic receptor, the only thing you can do is open the channel. So the channel looks, say, like this. And we bind the ligand or signal molecule, and we open the channel. But in the case of a metabotropic channel, a metabotropic receptor, the activated G protein or enzyme or second messenger can either open or close channels. And as a result of this, you can get much more varied responses out of metabotropic receptors. Now, what is an example of these two? We said that in the peripheral nervous system, one of the major neurotransmitters is acetylcholine. This is one of the biggies. Well, acetylcholine has two different receptors. It actually has even more, but it has two major types of receptor. And one of them is ionotropic, and one of them is metabotropic. This is called the nicotinic acetylcholine receptor, and this is called the muscarinic acetylcholine receptor. Now, when people talk about the acetylcholine receptor, they're talking about this one. This is one of the world's most famous receptors for a neurotransmitter. This is the one responsible for sending messages from nerve to muscle. And the picture that you have on your last handout on 18 derives from a synapse using this receptor. And this is a very important receptor. And how did it get this name? This is something I'll talk about in a second as how it got its name. Now, the muscarinic receptor, on the other hand, is indirect. And so it works through a G-protein coupled receptor, and its effects are varied depending on the type of G-protein it activates. There are variants of it, and it doesn't always work the same way. And these are involved also in the peripheral nervous system, and we'll get some examples of them later. Now, you don't want to look at it now, but in your notes, there is actually a table which compares the properties of these two receptors and the two classic types of receptors for norepinephrine. And that table is largely for reference. We will refer to these differences many times, and most of them you don't have to keep in your head. You do have to keep in your head which of these is direct and which of these is indirect, because it turns out to make a big difference. Now, how did they get these names? One of the ways that these receptors are studied is by adding drugs or chemicals that either inhibit them or mimic them. And the compounds that mimic the normal ligand are called agonists. And those that inhibit or block the normal ligand are called antagonists. Now, I think everybody's heard of antagonists. We understand that. That means it blocks the action, it gets in the way, it's counteraction. And the way antagonists are thought to work is you have a normal receptor, like we had over there, and you have a normal ligand. So when the ligand binds, you change the shape of the receptor, and that triggers some action. This is the normal ligand. An antagonist is thought to bind, but not to cause the change in conformation, not to activate the receptor. So the simplest case is if we have an antagonist, say, that looks like this. It binds. It prevents the normal ligand from binding, but it does not cause the conformational change. It doesn't activate the receptor. It doesn't trigger signal transduction. It just blocks the action of the normal ligand. That's a typical antagonist. Now, what's a typical agonist? Well, it's a mimic. So it also has to fit in. But unlike the antagonist, the agonist not only binds, but it causes the normal change in conformation. So it has the same effect, essentially, as the normal signal molecule. Now, one of the reasons these things are so useful is that they bind to things and serve as a kind of tag. Acetylcholine binds to both of these. So they're both called cholinergic receptors. But the compound nicotine, with which you are all familiar, binds to the direct acetylcholine receptor, but not to the indirect. And the compound muscarine binds to the indirect, but not to the direct. These are both agonists. They both mimic acetylcholine, but they're more specific than the original ligand. And so these receptors are named after their agonist, their most famous agonist. So if you want, in a lab setting, to trigger just this set, you use nicotine. And if you want to trigger just these, you use muscarine. Now, there's also a set of antagonists, which is listed in your table, which can be used to block either one of them, but not the other. And these are used both extensively in laboratory research, but agonists and antagonists are very, very useful as drugs as well. Many of the drugs in medical use are either agonists or antagonists of common signaling pathways. Now, Now, before we go on and talk about how you add up the IPSPs and the EPSPs and decide whether this could fire, I think we should take a minute to ask, to maybe compare some of the things we've been talking about. We've talked about IPSPs and EPSPs, postsynaptic potentials, excitatory or inhibitory. And we've talked about action potentials. Now, both of these are generated in sort of the same way. You open some channels, and a few ions move, and that changes the local voltage, and something happens. And then, after a while, it dies off. We go back to normal. We establish the steady state we had before. So that's a similarity in both of them. Change the conductance, change the permeability, flow a few ions. What's different? So what I want you to do is stop for a minute. If you can do it without looking at the type notes, great. If you have to cheat and look at the type notes, go ahead. But what are at least two of the differences between these types of potentials? What's the difference? Any difference? You name it. What do you think?
Sub-threshold.
Sub-threshold. So, what's the difference? This, which one?
Both of them are sub-threshold compared to the action threshold.
Oh, yeah, both of these together.
Yeah.
These together do not regenerate. Well, actually, his question, he says they're sub-threshold. If you have enough of them, they can be over the threshold. But each one of these, by itself, doesn't... Once you have one, it doesn't trigger another one, which triggers another one, which triggers another one. An action potential does. Once you get an action potential, it triggers the next, all the way down the line. So one way of looking at it is that this one is local, these are local, and these regenerate, and of course they travel all the way down the axon. Anything else? Yeah? Voltage-gated versus ligand-gated. So we said that to trigger one of these, you use a ligand. You need only ligand-gated channels to trigger this kind. But to trigger an action potential, you need voltage-gated channels. Anything else?
Potential is always constant, is always the same, whereas the others are varying.
Aha! The way we drew these, we just drew one of each. But she says the size of these can vary. And that's actually true. These are graded. If you have more stimulus, you can get a bigger, you sum up several IPSPs, and you get a total which is larger. But this one is invariant in size. There's another thing related to sort of invariant, which he hinted at. He said both IP and EPSP is local. Well, what's the difference between these?
Well,
One is depolarization, one is hyper. In terms of relative to resting membrane potential, one is in one direction and one is in the other. But what about action potentials? They're always positive, unless we count the after undershoot. But they're always positive, not sometimes positive, sometimes negative. Now, as I sort of said, an individual IPSP or EPSP is the same size, but the total you get is actually proportional to the stimulus. So when they add up, the total change in postsynaptic potential is in fact proportional to the stimulus. Now, if you get more stimulus, do you get a bigger action potential? Well, we already said no. So how do you know that it wasn't just a little warm when you touched the stove, but it was damn hot? You get more action potentials per second. So the number of action potentials is proportional to the stimulus. The frequency, or the number per unit time, is proportional. But here, the actual size, or in the sum, is different. So what we're really talking about here is a graded potential versus an invariant over the threshold once you trigger it potential. Another way to look at this is there's sort of one of these is analog and one of these is digital. Digital, you get zeros or ones. You either do it or you don't. That's an action potential. And it's the number of ones you get that tells you what's happening. But with analog, you get more and more as you get more stimulus, and that's what a graded potential is. It's more of an analog signal, more input, more received. Okay, so now how do you add up the IPSPs and the individual EPSPs and get what people call the total postsynaptic potential or the grand postsynaptic potential? How does that work? So that's shown on the bottom of today's handout on A. What we have there is you have a neuron, and this neuron is myelinated. And so if there were an action potential, it would go this way. But this is the cell body with dendrites. And where is the input? The input or the synapses into this cell are on the cell body and on the dendrites. So we've drawn one here. Now, from the picture, it looks like this sticks into the cell, but it doesn't. What we're saying is that this is an axon from another cell. This is its bouton or synaptic end. So there's a synapse under here on the surface of the big cell. So neurotransmitter is released here from the synaptic ending. This is the presynaptic cell and the postsynaptic. So, if you have, we've already said, if you have one EPSP, that is not enough to cause a firing of an action potential. Of course, one IPSP isn't either. Now, how do you add it together? Those little pictures you're looking underneath is what you would get more or less if you recorded from here. This section here is where you start an action potential if you're going to. So, in order to start an action potential, what do you need that you don't need to spread a graded potential? What kind of channels? You need voltage-gated channels. So there are no voltage-gated channels in the dendrites and in the cell body. There are ligand-gated channels, which respond to neurotransmitter, but there aren't any voltage-gated channels. But there are voltage-gated channels in the axon at the nodes of Ranvier, and there are a lot of them here at what is often called the axon hillock, or the initial or the trigger segment. Now, what happens is that if you have a local graded potential, it spreads locally, basically by diffusion of the ions. And all of these local potentials then are summed at this point at the axon hillock. If enough of them reach at the axon hillock, if the total depolarizes the cell to threshold, then you will generate an action potential and the cell will fire. However, if you don't reach threshold, the cell won't. So how can you reach threshold? Well, the very first picture says you don't. If you were to fire an action potential down the presynaptic neuron, then the cell, which is at acting, is at resting potential, would be depolarized a little bit. There'd be an EPSP. And if we fired another stimulus, there'd be another one. But we don't generate an action potential. Now, in picture two, what has happened? What if I fire an action potential presynaptically, and then I fire a second one right away? Well, then what's going to happen is I'm going to fire an action potential, and before the cell can repolarize, I fired another action potential. So more neurotransmitter comes, and there's more local depolarization, and I go over threshold, and I fire an action potential. So two inputs right after each other, or three or four, can add up. Because each one opens, releases more neurotransmitter, opens more channels, causes more postsynaptic potential, and I get over threshold and I fire. And this is called temporal summation. This is case B. How else could I get the cell over threshold? Another way would do it, which is in the third picture, is to have a second presynaptic neuron. If both of them release neurotransmitter at more or less the same time, I'll open more channels, depolarize more, and I'll go over threshold. So either one firing in quick succession or several firing at the same time, in general, it's an algebraic sum. So that's case C. So what happens is that the two doses of neurotransmitter together open enough channels, depolarize the cell, and we generate an action potential. Now, I said this is an algebraic sum. Now, on your handout, these are labeled E to mean that the synapses are excitatory. But what if you also had an inhibitory synapse? Now, if you fire an inhibitory synapse and an excitatory synapse at the same time, they both relate presynaptic neurons. They both release neurotransmitter, but one opens channels that depolarize, one opens channels that hyperpolarize, and the net effect cancels itself out, and you don't change the membrane potential enough to reach threshold and to fire. And that's the last case shown. That if you have both an excitatory and an inhibitory, you don't get anywhere. The way it shows it is I think it has the inhibitory first by itself, and then if you do inhibitory and excitatory at the same time, they cancel each other out, and there's essentially no change. So is the postsynaptic potential then is a graded potential, which is the sum of the input of all the EPSPs and IPSPs. And they travel locally to the axon hillock where they are summed, and if they are sufficient to have the cell go over threshold, the cell will fire an action potential. And you have to remember that the average cell has something like 1,000 inputs. And so it isn't just one or two that make the difference, but the net of all of them. All right. Now, what we've explained then is once you get input into a cell, how the output is determined, whether you will get an action potential or not. And there are two sort of pieces left to this that are very important. Well, how did we fire off this neuron? most of the examples we've been talking about, you stimulate it electrically. But that's not how you fire your neurons. You don't normally get electric jolts into your neurons in order to make them fire. They fire because of sight, sound, stretch, things like that. So you want to ask how you get this thing started. Then we want to ask, this neuron kicks another neuron. Eventually you get to what we call an effector. You get to a gland, you get to a muscle, the gland secretes, the muscle contracts. How does that work? So we want to look now at the two ends. First we're going to do the sensor end, and then probably next time we'll do the effector end. So before I do that, let me ask if there are questions so far, and then we'll go on. Yes? What does the sodium-potassium pump have to do with all this? In the short run, nothing. In the long term, though, the maintenance of the sodium-potassium imbalance is dependent on the pump. But as Dr. Feierstein said last time, you can run probably 100,000 action potentials before the effect of the pump, if you turn off the pump, before it makes any difference.
So then, is there a situation where you're actually adding more of those pumps into the
Do you ever change the number of pumps? In this kind of situation, no. Remember that the changes here are due to the opening and closing of channels. They are not due to changing overall concentrations due to the pump. Now, there are cases where the pump comes into play, but we'll talk about those later, and they don't come up here. Yeah?
What kind of signal would allow excitatory versus inhibitory channels?
What kind of signal would cause the channels, the receptors to change over time? Your question really is about the question of learning, which is what changes the synaptic wiring over time, and I don't know the answer to that. Yeah? Let me just say that any one synapse is always excitatory or inhibitory. That doesn't change. Yeah? Are all IPSPs and EPSPs the same size? In any given setup with neurotransmitter and receptor, they are approximately the same size, but they vary a little bit. It's a distribution. But they're all about, all EPSPs in a certain setup are about the same size. Yeah.
If there are voltage-gated channels in the dendrites or the soma of the neuron, how is the signal going from like a dendrite to the axon?
How does the signal get from here to there? And the answer is it's thought to be entirely passive. It does not involve any regeneration. And therefore, synapses that are further out are less likely to have an effect than in synapses that are closer in. Because the idea is that positive ions do spread, but they eventually do die out. Okay, so let's look at this business of how you get input from external sources. And this actually requires looking at the top of the handout. When we say external sources, we mean light, we mean sound, we mean heat, but we also mean the stretch in your stomach. It's external in a sense, but it's part of you. How do those things trigger off a nerve? Well, the basic idea is that each of these senses generates a graded potential in a cell, a special cell called a receptor cell, and that eventually opens or closes channels that generate action potentials. So this is another example of sort of the Big Bang theory, that the stimulus opens a few channels. If you open enough, you go over threshold and you fire an action potential. And then the action potential is carried to your brain. Now, of course, there's the question of, which Dr. Feierstein talked about, how do you know whether the signal was light or sound? And that's entirely in the wiring. That you have what he calls labeled lines. if the neuron goes to another neuron that goes to your hearing center, you perceive it as sound. And if it goes to the part of your brain that perceives sight, you will see it as light. And the example that he gave, which is that if you punch somebody in the eye, they see light or they see stars, because those are mechanical, those are light receptors, but you've triggered them off mechanically. Now, if you want a more innocuous example, when you get home, if you take a very sharp lead pencil and you go like this, you can see what happens. And by contrast, do this, because you have different receptors over here. Now, I'm not going to tell you what you're going to do. You'll see. Okay. The point is that the... Don't try it now. Most of the pencils you have aren't sharp enough. If you have... not by now, they're not. If you... The point is that although you are using touch, you will trigger other receptors besides the touch ones, and you will have a sensation different than pressure. But you try it. Okay. So the general scheme of how you pick up a stimulus is on the top of your handout. Now, it's written in sort of diagrammatic form, and then it's written in sort of a table underneath. The idea is that you have a stimulus, and it causes the opening of channels. In very rare cases, closing, but we'll stick to opening. Now, if you have a stimulus, such as pressure or a chemical like taste or smell, it's going to lead to the opening of channels. Now, how is it possible for something to open a channel? Well, we have the answer right up here. The receptor itself can be part of a channel, or the receptor can be a G-protein-coupled receptor that then activates a G-protein that indirectly activates a channel. So this can be either direct or indirect. Now, there are two things involved here. There is the receptor protein, and there is the receptor cell. So you see on the right here, we have two little cells. Here we have one like this, and one that looks sort of like this. These are meant to be the receptor cell. This is the cell that detects sound, light, etc. And it does that by having a receptor protein in it. And the thing that we're saying here is that this receptor protein can itself be part of a channel, in which case you have a direct receptor, or this receptor protein itself is not a channel, but it activates a G protein, which in turn ultimately opens a channel. So that's the difference between direct and indirect, whether you have an ionotropic receptor protein or a metabotropic receptor protein. So this is a G-protein coupled receptor. This is the receptor is itself a channel. Itself a channel. Now, once you open some channels, either through pressure, through light, through chemicals, once you open those channels, eventually you have to get yourself an action potential that goes down the nerves to the right place in your brain. Now, how do you get the action potential? And this diagram illustrates the two possibilities. One possibility is that the cell itself generates an action potential. That's what this symbol is. And the other possibility is that the receptor cell, because these are the receptor cells, these are the receptor proteins. That the receptor cell itself does not generate an action potential, but it releases neurotransmitter, and on the postsynaptic side, we have a more or less standard neuron, and it generates an action potential. Now, in both cases, when the stimulus contacts the receptor protein, what's going to happen in this part of the cell? You're going to get a graded potential. More stimulus, More open channels, more change in membrane potential, one way or the other. So this is called the third receptor thing. This is the receptor potential. And it is graded, just like an EPSP or an IPSP. But now, you have to turn the graded potential into an action potential in order to find out, know anything up here. So how do you do that? Some cells are capable of generating an action potential themselves. So this part is like an axon hillock. So in this cell, where are the voltage-gated channels? They have to be down here. Now, if this responds, say, to stretch, where are the ligand-gated channels? This is a trick question, because there aren't any. Mechanical stretch actually opens these channels. Mechanical stretch actually triggers these receptors, and that causes a graded response, and if it's sufficient, you generate an action potential. So there are mechanically gated channels in this part of the cell, and voltage-gated channels in this part of the cell. But there aren't any ligand-gated channels. And it happens stretch is a direct system, and it's one cell. Now, smell is a little different. The smell receptor cells look sort of the same. But they have ligand-gated channels, because each different chemical that you smell binds to a different receptor, different combination of receptors. So they have a whole bunch of ligand-gated receptors. The so-called odorant chemicals bind to them. And that is a metabotropic receptor. So what we're saying is stretch and smell both have this one cell setup where one end has a graded potential and the other end has an action potential. But stretch is a direct receptor. The stretch receptor protein is itself a channel. And smell receptors are G-protein-coupled receptors. This is a metabotropic or indirect system where the odorant binds to the G-protein, which generates a G-protein-coupled receptor, which activates a G-protein, which generates a second messenger, and that's what opens channels. Now, what's this thing on the top? And this thing on the top, the first cell has no area capable of generating an action potential. So it generates a graded potential in response to the stimulus, and the more graded potential, the more neurotransmitter. And then the neurotransmitter acts on the postsynaptic cell, just like any other case we talked about. And you get either an IPSP or an EPSP, and if you get over threshold, you fire an action potential. And taste works this way. Different tastes are detected differently. Some use direct receptors, proteins, some use indirect. But in all cases, the cell in your taste bud doesn't fire an action potential. It releases neurotransmitter, and the next cell fires an action potential. So this is how you get the information in. And that little thing on the bottom just sort of summarizes the little table, what's happening. And if you're interested in exact details, Sadafa goes through each one sense one at a time. Now, I just want to introduce the next idea. But maybe before I do that, I should ask if there are any burning questions about any of this. Yeah.
So when the one cell that is both sensing and sending an action potential, that one sort of like accumulates all the information, makes a decision based on the intensity. But the taste bud thing is always sending neurotransmitter. It doesn't have to accumulate.
Oh, his question is, this cell in the one cell system is going to release neurotransmitter. If you have a little bit of stimulus, it will release a little neurotransmitter. But then this cell won't fire. In this case, if you have a little bit of stimulus, you'll have a sub-threshold change, and this, if the cell itself will not fire. So it won't release neurotransmitter.
So the first cell in taste is always releasing neurotransmitter.
Is this cell always releasing neurotransmitter? Probably not if you're not tasting anything.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. One more. Yeah?
Do you know what happens in... So I think in certain types of synesthesia, you taste something when you hear a certain word. Is any receptor actually binding there?
I don't know the answer to her question. There are people who see flavors and hear colors, etc. Maybe some of you were like that. Some people say it enriches their experience. Some people say it drives them crazy. Those people are actively being studied to figure out what's going on, but I don't know what the answer is. And I don't think it's known, but I don't really know. One of our faculty has that, so I've heard about it, but I don't think anybody knows. Now, what I wanted to talk about next, very briefly, is on the other side of your handout for today. And this comes back to an old question that we've raised many times, which is if you start with the same signal molecule, how do you get different responses? Like we said, with estrogen, you get a different response in the uterus and the breast. And we said with epinephrine, you get a different response in skeletal muscle and liver. And that's attributed to the fact that there are other proteins in the cell already when you provide the signal molecule. And so the signal acts differently depending on whatever else is there. And one of the examples on this handout, the difference between the first two cases turns out to be exactly similar. Epinephrine has two different effects in two different cell types. Even though it uses the same receptor and the same signaling pathway, but the proteins to be modified are different. So you get a different result. But the case that I'm really interested in is the difference between the second case and the third case. Because here is a case where two types of smooth muscle respond in opposite directions to the same signal. Epinephrine makes some smooth muscle contract, and it makes some smooth muscle relax. Now, that sort of makes sense. When you have the pop quiz or you meet the lion in the street, you want to breathe more deeply. So you want the cells around your lung tubes to relax. You also want to divert your blood from your fingertips into your main body and your brain, so you want the smooth muscle around your fine blood vessels to contract. So that makes sense. But how is it pulled off? And the answer here is that there are two different receptors for epinephrine and norepinephrine, just as there are two different receptors for acetylcholine. There are actually more than two, but there are two major categories of what are called adrenergic receptors for adrenaline. These are called nicotinic and muscarinic. Those are cholinergic receptors. The adrenergic receptors are called alpha and beta. So bring back that handout next time, and we will go over those examples, and then we will discuss how you can get different results using different receptors and different pathways of signal transduction.